Okay.
You're good.
Okay. So, yeah, maybe this is good. Okay, so RCIA introduces a lot of material to you. And so you can kind of read your way into the church, and lots of Protestants have. But my experience as a convert is that you need time to learn how to think and worship as a Catholic, because you'll run into things and you'll want to know that your response is conforms with the faith tradition that you've taken on. Learn how to put on a Catholic spirituality and a Catholic mind. And so that's kind of what we're going to talk about here. As Helen said, distinctiveness may or may not be a real word. And when we think of distinctions, we frequently think of better or worse, and I'm going to try not to have that be what I mean. They're just different. I don't have a stop at 20 minutes talk at your tables activity, so we'll just stop so you can take a break. But we'll also, if you have a question that pops in your head, blurt it out. If I'm going to cover it, I'll say, I think we're going to get to that, but I want to make sure that we cover what you want covered, okay? Okay, so I want to say that when we're doing this contrast, this is all done with the greatest respect for all the gifts that come from our Protestant brothers and sisters, particularly their appreciation of the importance of just pure faith and their great affection for the scriptures. Not that we don't appreciate those things, but those are two characteristics of Protestant faith that they're well known for and deservedly appreciated for. Okay. So if you are raised in the Protestant tradition and you're going to become Catholic, it feels like you're changing teams. I certainly tried to present my membership card to Rhett Seiferman and have her stamp Catholic on it, and I go on my way. She wouldn't let me do that, and I really appreciate it because it takes time to understand it. But the Christian answer in most cases to questions that seem to be either or is no, that's not true. It's really both and. It is your heart, and it is your mind. It is, let's call that Saint Mary, praying at the feet of Jesus and spending an inordinate amount of money on some nice oil to anoint his feet. But it is also her sister Martha doing the work of serving the sick and the poor and the dispossessed. It is Good Friday. You cannot get away from the cross. That's why there's a crucifix. A big crucifix usually captures your attention when you go in a Catholic church. But don't forget, it's also the victory of Easter Sunday when the tomb is opened and Christ is resurrected. So these are the three basic things we're going to talk about. What do we mean when we say the word church? That's a big place where if you grab somebody from the pews across the street and they talk about the church, and when Catholics talk about the church, they're using the same word, but they don't necessarily mean the same thing. And the big, academic word for that is ecclesiology. Ecclesia is the Greek word for the church. So ecclesiology is the study of the church. The other big thing that's different is that emphasis on the sacramental and liturgical life. And then finally, this is what Helen was trying to warn you about. What's the toolbox that we use as Catholics when we go to unpack some mystery of the faith? What is the toolbox of reason? Yes, but what is the toolbox that the catechism is based on? Okay? They wrote the catechism using a particular intellectual... Yeah, thank you. There you go, we're done. But we're going to actually unpack that a little bit. You're exactly right. Okay. So one of the things, when we look at church, what do we mean by that? This is certainly what a lot of people think of when they think of the church and they think of Catholic Church. It's the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. And it is. But what about the people that are in the pews? There are a lot more of them than there are of him, right? I have to put this up because I'm hoping that that'll be me. Okay? Is it the clergy? Is it one particular person in the clergy? Is it all the lay people? Well, the Catholic Church would say, or a Catholic would say, is it even all the people that are alive? We talk about the communion of saints. That's what that's supposed to represent. But we also have those who are not yet in heaven, but are on their way in purgatory. You'll often hear the term the church militant, which is those of us who are currently breathing, the church triumphant, the people, the saints in heaven, and the church suffering, those who are in purgatory, and they are making satisfaction for the sins that they committed. When we go to reconciliation, our sins are forgiven, but there is a debt that needs to be paid for the sins that we committed. And Psalm 51 talks about, I have sinned against you alone, God, because ultimately my sin, even if I did it to you, is ultimately a sin against God. I need to make sure we're square, but I also need to pay God. And purgatory is that place where we purify ourselves through satisfaction of the temporal sins, okay? So the church is, in the Catholic mind, is not bound by geography, and it's not bound by time, because those people, they're beyond time. So we're still here, breathing, and our time on earth will end, but our time in the church won't. We have in the church unity and diversity. It's not a hierarchy where you just sort of run everything up a memo system to the bishop in Rome and he decides everything. Actually, Archbishop Gregory is personally responsible for the care of our souls here in his diocese. So he is a brother to, that's Benedict, but Pope Francis. They only go to the Pope when there's something that is beyond the scope of the ability of his brother in Atlanta to handle, or when the bishops all come together in a synod to discuss something. So we have, and within Atlanta, we have diversity. We're all saying the Mass, but we say it in Korean, we say it in French, we say it in Spanish, we say it in English, we say it in Latin, we say it from time to time, I think, in Polish. Okay, here in the Atlanta Diocese. We say it with different types of bands at the front or the back of the church, depending on which Mass you go to, depending on which parish you go to. So there's a lot of diversity in that unity. And if you remember from the Creed, we say that it's one. So when we talk about church as Catholics, we're talking about that whole thing, which we can see discreetly in our parish, or just the 9 o'clock Mass, but it connects across time and space to all Christians who ever were and ever will be. And it was given, protected by the Holy Spirit, entrusted to Peter, because Jesus' prayer was that we all would be one. Sadly, we are tempted by the snares of the devil, and it ended up looking like this. So you can see that early on, there was a disagreement about things. These are some of the early councils of the church. And people disagreed about the nature of Jesus, and they went off on their way. Then there was a split between what we call the Greek Orthodox, or the Eastern Orthodox, and the Western Orthodox, which is us, the Latin Rite. And then, really, big split, the Reformation, which we'll touch on a little bit. So, we're supposed to be one. We've ended up with this, which is, for some of you, why you're here. I want to get back on the red line. Okay? Okay. This is another thing that is something you hear about when you talk about Catholics and Protestants, faith and works. And many times Protestants, when they're not feeling charitable, say that you Catholics believe in works, but I believe in faith. and Catholics look at them and say it's not just faith, it has to be works. This has been a question that's been around a long time, so I thought I would kind of walk us through some of these things. You're going to need that in a minute. So here is St. Paul. This is probably one of the bits of verse that would be thrown at a Catholic if we were slinging verse at each other. For we hold that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law. That's from the letter to the Romans. St. James, who is frequently put as the other side of this stuff, writes in his letter, just a few years later, for just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead. So we're still trying to figure out what that means. So we're going to go forward just a little bit more to St. John. And he wrote in his gospel, if you keep my commandments, which sounds a little bit like works to me, you will remain in my love, which sounds a little bit like faith to me. It didn't stop there. There was a British monk named Pelagius who was very tuned in to the fact that we have free will. We can decide for ourselves what we're going to do. So Dr. Seuss, you know that big poem, that's what he's touching on. We decide which way we're going to go. And he made the point that if you actually chose properly, you could do right enough to find yourself in heaven. You could work your way into heaven. And St. Augustine said that's absolutely not true. Everything we have is a gift. It's all a gift of grace from God. In fact, the desire to want to do good is a gift from God. So yes, you have free will, but that choosing to use that free will to do something good is in fact a gift from God. This strongly affected a certain Augustinian monk in the 16th century. And he wrote his 95 Theses and he put it up on the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. And he really tapped into the fact that it's all grace. Works don't count for anything. And he ended up, he was a very emotional person, he ended up concluding that what we are snow-covered piles of dung. Dung is an old word for something. We don't use that word anymore. But that's what he thought. That was his sense, that we are so crappy that we can't do anything on our own. It is entirely God doing it for us. They held a council to sort of, how are we going to respond to this Continental Reformation called the Council of Trent. And I just want to point out, canon, that's item one on the Council of Trent was, if anyone says that a man may be justified before God by his own works, whether done through the teaching of human nature or that of the law, without the grace of God through Jesus Christ, let him be anathema. Off with his head. He's not part. That's what anathema means. Okay? So there's precious little in Catholic teaching that would suggest that somehow faith and works are separate. And so I introduce the Toblerone to make this point, okay? Come up here, sweetheart. So, it's not the gift of salvation, but if Helen gives me, you guys know what a Toblerone is? Okay? A delicious Swiss milk chocolate bar with delicious toffee crunches in it, lovingly wrapped in fancy foil and then put in this beautiful triangular box, okay? Put in little pieces so you can share, but all connected so you don't have to. Okay? So if Helen gives me the gift of the Toblerone, my work is holding on to the gift. If I stop making any effort at all, the Toblerone falls on the floor. It's in a box, so I'll eat it later. But that's the point. I think that for we're Catholics, we're not going to open it.
I thought we were going
to
open it.
No. Our work as Christians is to hang on to the gift that we were given. And you can't pretend that that's not work. That's effort. Okay? So that's how I think faith and works really work, is to hold on to the gift that we were given. But if you just grab a verse here and a verse there, you can end up contorting yourself into something that is really not what the church teaches. And that brings us to the next thing that I think is important for us to understand, is that the church founded by Jesus, given under the protection of the Holy Spirit to the care of St. Peter and his successors as the Vicar of Christ, that's one of the titles of the Pope, is supposed to carry on the office, the work of Christ. And we talk about Christ having a threefold office, and we find a threefold office continued in his church. Christ is the high priest. This is an Old Testament priest with his ephod on and the incense. The job of the priest was to offer sacrifices to sanctify the people, to make them holy. Christ is also the eternal prophet. There is Elijah being fed by the ravens. The prophet's job was to give the word of God to the people and to correct them when they wandered off astray. Christ is also the eternal king. Here is King Solomon. So these are continued in the office of sanctifying. That's why we talk about our priest as in persona Christi, or an alter Christus. He is in the person of Christ, or he is another Christ when he is doing the sanctifying activity, which is saying the Mass. We talk about the office of teaching. I put Latin up there to impress you. The office of teaching, we talk, that's what the magisterium is. Okay, so that job of the magisterium, I think I showed this in a slide before, is to keep us on the right side of the rails. Okay, and then the office of governing. One of the things for American secular culture raised people is, where's the balance of power? You got the Archbishop Gregory. His name is on every single piece of property here. When the Margaret Mitchell heir died and had been so well treated by his pastor here, and he left all his money to his pastor, he left it actually all to the Archbishop, no matter what he thought he was doing. And then the Archbishop and the pastor have a discussion about what are we going to do with all this money. Okay? So everything is owned by the Archbishop. The Archbishop is the legislator and the judge and the executive branch, all in one person. Okay, that's what the office of governing does. Okay, so that's very different from the vestry at St. Philip's picks who's going to be the rector of St. Philip's. The parish council here tells the pastor what they've heard going on. That's what he wants to do with it. Okay, so one of the things that's different for whether you're just Catholic raised in the secular world, you're looking for balances of power the way you learned in your civics classes, or you've seen if you were raised in the Protestant church, and they just aren't here. That's all held in a person. Now, there's a lot of responsibility for that person, but that's how we're structured. Okay, so that's a couple of things. Now I'm going to move about church. Now I'm going to move to sacraments. Any questions about church or comments about that before we go forward?
Wait for a second.
Yes, ma'am.
So, works doesn't actually refer to working.
Works doesn't refer to working? I mean, it could. Those all fit in there, absolutely. Okay, if the Lord has given me the ability to make an above average wage, okay, what do I do with that gift? I give it back to him. If the Lord has given me the ability, hasn't given me that ability, but he's given me the ability to be free on Saturdays when there's a Habitat for Humanity build, I could go do that. It's really what I do with the time and the energy and the material gifts that I've been given. Am I using them to glorify him, or am I using them to glorify me? So if I put money in the basket because I expect to be invited to the major donor dinner here, that's probably not a good gift. I mean, give me the money anyways, but you want to do it for the right reason. And Pelagius probably wasn't scheming, but it's the kind of thing that can get perverted, okay? If you just, you know, if you put enough money in the box, you'll go to heaven. And one of the reasons why Martin Luther was so outraged was because outrageous things were being done. So these men don't have a balancing act of power. So if the Pope decides what he wants to do is build a really big church in Rome called St. Peter's, and he somehow gives the impression to aggressive, ambitious monks that if they bring a lot of money to him, that'll further their careers. And then if a monk were to say, you know, if you put money in the box, it's like an indulgence. It's less time you'll spend in purgatory. So people are putting money in the box to buy indulgences. You can see how something that could be really good gets terribly perverted. I think I made the point before, but I'll make it again. Most of the popes are Saint Pope this or Saint Pope that. None of the popes in the Renaissance are Saint Pope this or Saint Pope that. So there's a good example where for a number of years, in a couple hundred years, the men were not worthy of the office to which they had been entrusted. We saw in the whole bishop and priest scandals that we first heard about through Boston, where there was a systemic failure on the part of the men to deal with the fact that the men, you put a collar around a guy's neck, doesn't make him holy, right? So if you've got a bad guy, we've seen this with the police here recently, right? Just because he's got a blue shirt and a badge doesn't mean he's not prone to doing something he shouldn't do, giving into weakness, abusing his power. It's true of the church as well. So there are stretches and there are spots where the men, and we are, our clergy is all male. I'm sure this happens in the convents too, I just don't know. Where they're just not worthy of the office that they've been given. And that's when the people have to be willing to be strong enough to say, hey, you're doing it wrong. St. Catherine of Siena is a great model of that. What the Spotlight group did for the Boston Globe is honestly a great model of saying, hey, we're going to speak the truth and suffer the consequences. So what makes it a work is I was doing it for myself. What makes it holy is I'm doing it to glorify God. Does that help? Yes.
Did you explain buying indulgence?
I touched on it.
Okay. Is it bad or good?
Buying indulgences is probably bad. Indulgences is, honestly, it doesn't have a lot of traction for me personally, so I may not properly explain it. But basically, the idea is that the saints, with their saintly behavior, have accumulated merits. And if you're an accountant, they've got a surplus. So they would share them with us, and we could benefit from their merits. And so the indulgences is some sort of a accounting mechanism to get some of the merits of Saint whoever over to the sinner Brad. That's a gross oversimplification, but I think that captures the essence of it. Okay. So indulge me in that bad explanation. Yeah. Yes, sir. Great question. I wasn't there. I honestly don't know. You do see, and I forget where in the scriptures, I think it's in John, that they begin to use the word synagogue when they're referring to collections of Jews, and they begin to use the word church, ecclesia, when they're talking about collections of the people that were going to end up being the Christians. But they don't start calling them Christians until the book of the Acts, and it mentions that in there. That was the first, in Antioch was the first place they were called Christians. Somebody raise their hand over here.
I was just wondering why there isn't a balance of power. Like, why is it all under the archbishop?
Well, it's all under Christ. Okay, so the monarchy is really the natural order of organization for the church because God is sovereign. Now, I want to balance the standard of care for the legislator, the competent authority, Archbishop Gregory, is he has to be, he's responsible for my soul. So if he screws up, it has a terrible ripple effect. Okay, it's kind of like a father, you know, if you mess up for your kids, it's a bigger mess up. So, and he's supposed to operate knowing that, which is why when they go around cavalierly doing stupid stuff, it's a bigger deal. Is that okay? Yep. Nope.
So,
more.
Well, who keeps him in check?
Well, that's a good question. Hopefully, his confessor, he has a spiritual director. Hopefully, he has surrounded himself with good counselors. Hopefully, he has a well-formed conscience. Hopefully, the Holy Spirit properly guided the Holy Father in picking him to be our pastor. I can just be assured, I have interacted with him personally when I was in a bit of a crisis, so he's awesome. But not everyone is, and not everyone has been. Yes, sir.
One thing that would hold any archbishop to read this check to be the authorities of the Pope.
Right.
The Pope can ask an archbishop or a bishop to resign.
Right.
And it's a very embarrassing.
So the mechanics of that is you would say, I think he's doing something wrong. And you would write to Rome. You probably have to write them a few times. And eventually, they would say, we're getting some static from Atlanta. We better go find out what Leanne would raise as the problem. Okay? And it could be liturgical. He's using a loaf of Wonder Bread, and that's not permitted for the, okay? It could be organizational. You know, he's abusing his priests. He's moving around every 18 months and putting them, the ones he doesn't like, he puts off in the mountains and he won't ever let them come back. He has obligations to his assistants. Anything else? One more.
Just one more.
That's all right.
Why aren't there women in the, I mean, like, I know nuns are a part of the church, but what is the Catholic belief behind not having female priests?
This is...
Wait, will you say the question?
Why are there no women priests? Or no women clergy? I guess the simple short answer is Christ had whatever he chose to do. He did not choose to ordain women. There's a lot of other stuff that gets built up around that, but if you just unpack it, he chose not to do it, so we're not going to reinvent it.
We'll cover that in the class of
holy orders. Yeah, I think we will.
And I get to teach that too.
Okay. Okay. Any more? Leanne, you got any more?
Not yet.
Okay. That's good. No, the questions are great. Okay. All right. So now life in the Catholic Church. It's sacramental. Well, what do we mean by that? A sacrament, and I was going to contrast it to like your rosary. Okay, this is a sacramental. This is a little thing used to help you with your prayer life, your pious practices. A sacrament, and we've defined seven of them in the church, is something where we believe that God, who is pure spirit, makes himself present in an effective way through material things, okay? So water and particular words said in a particular way is the sacrament of baptism. The husband and the wife coming together, giving themselves with particular words and a blessing over them is the sacrament of holy matrimony. And God's gift of himself, his love, comes through that sacrament and empowers, in the case of the couple, them to be a sign of God's love in the world, to change the world, okay? The word sacrament is the Latin word that translates the Greek word for mystery, okay? When we see the word mystery, we think of this guy, that's Sherlock Holmes, for those of you who are too young to remember before Robert Downey Jr., okay? And what we're talking about is a mystery where something is happening that, you know, reason doesn't quite explain it. There's a bush that's on fire, but it doesn't get consumed, okay? The priest blessed this bread and wine, and it is no longer bread and wine. It is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, okay? So a sacrament or a mystery is something that we enter into rather than struggle to solve. Okay? You can't solve the real presence. You just have to kind of enter into it. Okay? So that's a big thing that's different from our Protestant brothers and sisters. They don't have many sacraments, one or two typically, depending on their faith tradition. The other thing that really marks us is liturgical. And liturgy is basically the appointed duties of the people. It's what we as a worship group have been told to do to glorify God in our worship. Okay? So we're worshiping him according to how he told us to do it. So you go to the Last Supper, you asked about why there are no female priests. There were definitely women there, but who, when he instituted the priesthood, it was the 12 men. Those are the men whose feet he washed. That is why when you get, from time to time, you have a bit of a thing going in the press when some, you know, orthodox, technically correct, but perhaps pastorally untuned bishop says we should only wash the feet of men. Because part of what's going on in the Holy Thursday liturgy is we're recalling the institution of the priesthood in addition to recalling the institution of the Mass. Okay, that doesn't sell well, so most bishops find some way around it. I think our bishop is, we're washing the feet in this parish of 12 first communicants. So there's 12 little kids. It's kind of cute. Okay, but we do what we're told to do. And now a picture, there is our current pope doing what he's told to do. So he's doing the Mass. He has a job. There he is with his censer incensing the altar. There's his deacon to his right. There's his master ceremonies behind him. Okay? The photographer is taking the picture from where we would be, and we have what we're supposed to do in the Mass. Okay? And the liturgy, we just do it, and the act of doing it makes us more holy, even if we're not really feeling it. So this idea of just doing it, whether or not you get anything out of it, is a big place of difference. Which is why if you're a zealous Baptist becoming a Catholic and you meet some cradle Catholic and he can't answer any questions about anything, but he goes to Mass every Sunday and he's a good Catholic, and it's a little hard to process that, because how can you call yourself a good Catholic when you don't know anything about your faith and all you do is come every Sunday? I'm doing what I was told to do. Come to Mass every Sunday and the Holy Days of Obligation. So one of the cool things for me about the Catholic faith is that if you just want to be dumb as a donkey, you can be a good Catholic. If you want to go be some high-flying intellectual deep thinker, no matter how high or how deep you go, the church has been there. And there's some really cool person, guy or girl, who has thought about these questions and written really cool stuff about it. It might be 1,800 years old. It might be 18 years old. But it's just incredibly full. Okay. All right. Here we go. We'll take our time through this. Seven sacraments. Uh-oh. I'm in trouble. So we call, there are seven sacraments. Three of them are the sacraments of initiation. So those of you who are unbaptized, on Easter Vigil, you're going to get the three, one after the other. You're going to be baptized, you're going to be confirmed, and you're going to receive First Eucharist. Those are the three sacraments of initiation. Okay? Baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist. There are two sacraments of healing. Unction, which is the anointing of the sick for physical healing, and penance, reconciliation, which is for spiritual sickness. Okay? And then there are two sacraments of service. Holy orders, where the man has given himself entirely to the church, and holy matrimony, where the man and the woman have given themselves entirely to each other to glorify God. Okay? Those are the seven sacraments.
And each sacrament gets a class or
a half. Right, we'll have a class on those. Okay, does that make sense? What else did I forget, sweetheart? Okay. Well, if I did, you just remind me. It's really great being a man. Get a lot of help. And I need it. I need it. No. The great philosopher Dirty Harry said, a man's got to know his limitations. And I know mine. Okay. So, we talked about sort of the answer was Thomas Aquinas, but I'm going to get us to Thomas Aquinas here, okay? So this is, if I run into something I'm puzzled about and I don't have Helen or Brad handy and I don't have my catechism, how would I go about trying to figure out how to approach this question that interests me, okay? We've been given the gift of reason, okay? God is reasonable, meaning he is rational. You can come to know him through your power of reason. And that our using our reason to participate in his eternal law is what we call natural law. That operates under his eternal law. So there are things that we know just because God revealed them to us. I showed you the burning bush. God just said, Moses, bammo, here you go, I am God. Take off your shoes. You're on sacred ground, right? And Moses' face was turned white because he was in the presence of God. So there are things that we are just given. The Trinity. You're just given the Trinity. Okay? But there are things that we can come to understand through the power of our reason. Examples of that are like murder. Okay? You go across cultures and it's just a natural thing. People know that taking an innocent human life is wrong, whether they are Bedouins or Polynesian, whatever they are, or American secularists. Even American secularists know that taking innocent human life is wrong, which is why so much of the pro-abortion, they're trying to not define that as human, because that way they can't be guilty of any kind of a murder, because that's not yet a person. So there are things like murder, adultery, lying, we just sort of naturally can reason to that those are wrong. So the Catholic framework for reasoning is largely due to Aristotle through St. Thomas Aquinas. So what St. Thomas did was he tried to apply, Aristotle had a system for categorizing everything. Natural stuff, physics, and then mental stuff, metaphysics. And Thomas decided to take that framework, which had been recently rediscovered through interaction with the Muslims, to questions of theology. So he wrote a really big book, which you've probably seen but don't want to open, called the Summa Theologica, where he sat down and systematically kind of said, okay, we're going to consider this question of the faith. And he has a framework that he does it. And then he goes to the next question of the faith, okay? And he logically laid out the teachings of the church, and we continually refer back to it. So what are the keys to this Aristotelian or Thomistic Catholic way of thinking? That things are real, okay? That things can be categorized and examined for what they really are, their essence, or in Latin, their substance. You've heard of consubstantial with the Father, transubstantiation. We're talking about what is that really is, okay? Or their features, also called their accidents, how they look, their posture, how they feel, those types of things. And also their causes, what made them, and what they are made for, okay? So here's my example. What's that? What's that? What's that? Right, that's another one, okay? One's red, one's got a right angle, one's white, one's maybe almost a right angle. They're different colors, okay? But there is something that we can call a triangle. So the thing is a triangle, and we can kind of define it. It's got three sides. The interior angles add up to 180 degrees. But it's also got features or accidents, like it's exactly which each of the angles is, what the color is, things like that, how big it is. So that is really kind of Aristotelianism in a little pictogram, okay? So what we're talking about here in Thomas's language is universals. And then we can talk about individuals, like, and that's where you get cases, or individual items and entities. And all of this emphasizes the objective nature of things, the objective dimension of reality. You may hate triangles, but they're still triangles. It doesn't matter how you feel about them, they just are, okay? Getting back to that Catholic who just goes to Mass, it really doesn't matter. It'd be great if you were actively participating, but the Mass will happen whether or not you're checking your email, okay? So the Mass, the liturgy is objective. And Aristotelian Thomism kind of really emphasizes the objective dimension of reality. Okay? The other choice is a thing called nominalism, kind of introduced 100 or 200 years after Thomas by William of Ockham. You might have heard of Ockham's razor, which is that the simplest explanation is the most likely to be true. Well, he also said, "You're wrong, Thomas. There's no such thing as a universal. The reason we call that a triangle is because we saw a bunch of them and we gave the name triangle to them. But there are no universals, there are only names, and nominalism means names, okay? This is kind of where Martin Luther found himself, very in touch with the subjective dimension of reality, because reality is both objective, but it's also the subjective dimension, how I feel about things. Mass is a whole lot better if I get something out of it, right? It doesn't depend on my getting something out of it, but it's a lot better if I do. So the fullness of reality includes both the objective dimension and the subjective dimension. We as, you know, imperfect beings tend to get drawn more or less to one or the other. You know, you think about all the ways we categorize people, left brain, right brain, all those types of things where introvert, extrovert, a lot of that is kind of which of these kind of clicks with me naturally and which one is more of a stretch for me. Mostly that's what it comes down to. So it's me giving a name to it that gives it its significance. And I thought I would use a couple of examples of how we see this play out. Marriage is a great example of that. Our subjectively dominated culture says that we can redefine marriage. So if two guys say that they love each other and are committed to each other till death do them part, and they want to call that marriage, then who am I to disagree with them? And that is basically the line for the pro-gay marriage. Have I accurately stated that? Is that unfair in any way? Okay. The Catholic Church says marriage has a definition, that it is a man and a woman, that it is a lifelong relationship of faithfulness and openness to children. So as much as those two guys could love each other and be committed to each other and be faithful to each other, there's no way they can be open to children. They don't have the appropriate plumbing because they don't complement each other. Okay? So it's not that you couldn't adopt, it's that your essence, you're missing something, okay? So the church, in fact, now with their new marriage rite, they've recognized that if we call it marriage, they're calling it marriage, and we don't mean the same thing they mean, perhaps we should reappropriate the old term, holy matrimony. And you're going to see more and more where the church is using the word holy matrimony to make sure you understand that we're talking about the thing that our term has never changed. We don't see how the term can change because it was given to us by God, who doesn't change. Yet the world around us has changed that term because the world around us is so affected by this how I feel about things. Okay? Does that work? Okay. Anybody want to add to this or poke it? Yes, sir. It's not really believe, but when we go to write a paper on something, when we go to write the catechism, this is the toolbox that we're really using. And you'll notice when you read the catechism, it will have words like substance, category, proper, okay? Proper doesn't mean good manners, like a proper young man. Proper means it has to do with accidents, unique to this particular one, okay? When you open the missal, you have the propers, the things, the prayers that are said for this particular feast day, okay? Well, these words are in the catechism, because the catechism was written to be a resource for the bishops to exercise their office of teaching. They really didn't think that every single guy on the street was going to buy a copy and read it. Okay, and that's why we sometimes get confused by things, because we read the catechism, we don't quite understand. We're reading, it's kind of like a cliff note. It's written for a particular audience, making assumptions about what they know. And that's why it's really good to find something to read with the catechism. It's also, if you look at the catechism, you'll see how much of the catechism is really pointing you to other documents. Yes, a Catholic lens would be a good way to think of that, yes.
What's the nominal?
Is that the nominal? So the nominalism is, they're rejecting this,
yeah.
So it's kind of, you get to define what you want to define, which is why you can redefine marriage.
Okay, so maybe more secular world then.
Well, it's not secular, it's just that how I feel is hugely important to me. You remember I said that Martin Luther said we are snow-covered piles of dung?
Yeah.
The Catholic response might really be, Martin, you are made in the image and likeness of God, as it says in Genesis. So what we really are is a beautiful snowflake, and we have allowed some dung to land on us. Okay? So he kind of got it backwards. He was a very emotional guy. He said he had his greatest thoughts in cloaca when he was really down in the dumps. He was terribly depressed. Maybe that's not the best place to ponder the big questions of reality, but he was strongly affected by all the sin he saw around him. He was strongly and deeply in tune with the fact that there's no way that he as a sinner could deserve the gift of salvation. And so this is kind of, he said, look, I don't deserve it. There's no way I can do it on my own. It's got to be entirely a gift. And he's not really wrong in that. It is a gift. But we have a response that we're asked to do. Okay? Does that help? Okay. So I think that it. Any other questions?
He doesn't have to stop there because you just confused the whole room. So
okay. Would you like me to go over it again? It's really, how do I have a balance between things that just are, whether I feel them or not, and my feelings? Okay. My feelings are real. But, and I, this is certainly true for me, I assume it's true for most of you, there are times when I really felt something and then found out later that was a bad feeling. It wasn't really based in reality. So my feelings, my heart, is easily sort of co-opted. You know, you go to a movie and you're weeping because, you know, the main character died. You know, so our feelings and our, you know, our kindness and our generosity, our good, can be manipulated. And it's not just Hollywood. I mean, the devil is out there working with what he can, and misusing our feelings is a big one. Pride, but also the kinder side of ourselves. Yes. Okay, so most Protestant philosophy, okay, most Protestant philosophical writings, if you really unpack it, will involve a rejection of Thomism, okay? Because their early fathers were very subjectively dominated, okay? Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. What she said, then what exactly is the role of nominalism within a Catholic worldview?
I think the Catholic worldview would say you're better off focusing on what's real,
okay,
and then adding as a icing to the cake how you feel about it, rather than starting with how you feel and seeing if you can construct a reality around that. Is that better? Okay. So let's go to the Mass, okay? If it's Father with an unpronounceable name because he just came here from Kenya and you can't really understand his English, my son was baptized into Tefet, not the faith, okay? It doesn't make the Mass invalid, okay? Whereas if that guy went and preached for 45 minutes at Passion City, that'd be the last time he preached there. Because what's important is that the pastor, the preacher at Passion City, passionately connect with the people and then fill them up with something, okay? You look at just how we worship. Those pews are profoundly uncomfortable because we don't spend the most of our time sitting, reclining, receiving, right? We do have a part of that, the liturgy of the word. We sit and we receive the word, and then we receive some kind of explanation of it in the homily. But the rest of the Mass, we're up and down doing stuff because that's our role, okay? So even just in our body motions in Mass, we are focused on doing what we're told, whether or not, you know, we're really getting anything out of it. It's not focused on us, it's focused on Jesus. You might have heard of this bit of a brouhaha about ad orientem worship. You look at our worship space, and there's a big metal table right in the middle of the sanctuary, right? There's a bigger, higher stone table behind it. That's the altar. We added this other altar because it was pointed out that there might be times when it would be good to say Mass with the priest facing the people around the table. After 40 years of that, subjectively, many of us lost the sense that what we're all doing is worshiping Jesus. Okay? So what happened was when he turned back to the original posture, his facing with the people to Jesus, that's been recast as turning his back on the people. When I say turning his back on the people, who does that imply is the center of our worship? Us. When I say turning with the people to face his Lord, who does that remind me is the center of our worship? Would it be easier to focus on Jesus if you didn't look at Father Frank, as good looking as he may be? It would, wouldn't it? Part of why our priests are men in basically bags is because, I mean, you know, it's just a big old poncho, right? We might have put gold fabric on it, but it's just a big poncho. Ideally, we're not going to be distracted by how good-looking Father What a Waste is, or, you know, or how ugly he is, okay? Because we're not supposed to get distracted by the guy. We're supposed to be focused on the Lord. So those are all kinds of things where just in our own experience, we realize how easy it is for us to inadvertently make ourselves the center of our worship, and God is supposed to be the center of our worship. Do we have a time limit here? I'm just going to recite poetry for the next 7 minutes.
Okay. What were they supposed to do with that last little Catholic philosophy piece? How does that fit? Like, what's the point of knowing that?
The point of knowing that is to maybe have a mental check as you find something in the Catholic stuff you read and you trip over it. It causes you to bristle or be confused, okay? If you're like me, you'll start with a bristle, then you'll try to read to find out I'm just confused, okay? I didn't like something I just read. When I go to try to understand it more, I need to be attuned to the fact that the objective dimension of reality, the willingness to just define something, accept it as defined, and then as a second step, see how I feel about it, is a better system of exploration than starting with how I feel about it and then finding data to support how I feel. Okay. Now, some Catholic writers are prone to this. They kind of know what the answer should be, and they make up an argument to fix it. Okay, does that help? I don't know.
I just want to make sure that he's like,
I'll certainly, John?
Yeah, Paul says to Timothy, that, 1 Timothy, that people will have itching ears. They will find a teacher to tell them what they want to hear.
That's right.
And that's why we have to test the faith, make sure something true for me, it was also true for Brad, but also true for Brad 500 years ago. Like, that's the nature of the truth. There are truths that stay true throughout time and in all places and for all people, and not just in America for how I feel about it in the 21st
century. Yeah. Because God is eternal, right? He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Okay? Well, if he's eternal, he doesn't change. So, if there's any gap between me and him, I'm the one that moved, not him. So if I'm going to close the gap, I've got to move, because he's not moving. Because he can't, because he's eternal. Okay? So, when I'm stumbling with something and I don't feel I'm connecting with God or the church or whatever, or another person, most of the time it's me. So to use a toolbox that starts with me, myself, and I, it's probably not going to be fruitful. So I should start with a toolbox that says, what is? That's the name of God, right? I am who am. Jesus uses it all the time in the Gospel of John, it's kind of like, I am who am. You know, he's reminding them that before Abraham was, I am. Deal with it. Okay? And it was hard for them. So no wonder if it's hard for us. Okay, I think with that I'm going to put the microphone down. Okay. But I'll stay here.
But he will stay after if you need to come after.